Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The Minister of Silly Walks is coming to Baltimore tonight. Well, he's not actually the minister. He's just an hilariously officious bureaucrat. But you know who I mean. John Cleese of Monty Python, of Fawlty Towers, of the movie A Fish Called Wanda, and much, much more. John Cleese will be in Baltimore tonight for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. Right now, John Cleese is on the phone with us. Welcome to On the Record.
Yeah, and I'm going to be talking to someone rather interesting, but I've forgotten her name. What is it? Sheila something, isn't it?
Sheila. My name is Sheila.
Yes, I know. I was making a joke. I'm sorry.
Let me start with this. You have often satirized authority figures and snobs like Basil
yes.
Fawlty, who aspires to be in a higher social class than he is. How did you come to enjoy lampooning this particular group of people?
Oh, I suppose it was because I went to English public school. My parents weren't at all grand. Dad sold insurance. But they had a little bit of money, and they had me educated privately, which in our strange language in England means I went to a public school. And as a result of that, I grew up surrounded by the children of architects and lawyers and accountants, the middle class, the professional middle class, so that I was always able to pass myself off as that, although really I was in the lower middle class. But, I mean, when you're making fun of people, you're only making fun of people because they're not doing whatever they're supposed to be doing properly, whether it's a human being in a relationship or someone in a job. You can't make fun of someone who's doing a job well. Laughter is about faults and where human beings fall short, you see what I mean? Not about where they succeed.
Has your sense of humor changed as you've gotten older?
I think it's got broader in the sense that the spectrum of things that makes me laugh has got wider and wider. I can sit and read Sid Perelman, you know, this kind of quite dry, witty New York stuff. And at the same time, I can bust a gut when I see a really good French farce. And I love visual comedy. I go right back to the people who laid the rules of comedy down, like Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and W.C. Fields. I mean, I think they were the greatest. And I don't think that we produce a lot of comedy as good as that anymore. I think that there was a golden period in Hollywood. But I think the problem now is that people are funny, but they don't understand structure. So they don't really structure the films as they used to in the old days. And that's why I've just adapted a farce that was written in 1895, because the plotting is much better than most of the plotting these days.
Do you think of yourself more as a writer than a performer?
I think so, yes. I don't think it's fair for me to expect anyone else to, because obviously they see me performing. They don't see me sitting there writing. But I've always felt the thing that I'm really good at is writing, and that I'm a good performer. I'm a good technical comedy performer within a sort of limited range of characters. I don't have the character strokes that Michael Palin has. But yes, I do think I'm a good writer, because I think I can combine, you know, really original stuff with a good structure. I keep going on about structure, but I think I've also got a sort of a good left brain in the sense that I was trained first as a scientist and then as a lawyer. So I can do that kind of logical stuff that enables me to kind of stitch the clever, funny, original bits together in a satisfying way.
I ask in particular because when you talk about the importance of structure, I'm wondering if that's something that you feel innately, that you can feel in the moment on a stage or before a camera, or whether it's something more intellectual that you need to think out in front of a keyboard.
Well, I think it depends on the length of the work you're talking about. I think if you're talking about a 3-minute sketch, sometimes you can get an idea and you can almost immediately see what the shape of that has to be. But if you're doing a movie, which is a great challenge, it's very, very hard to get a comedy movie right. Then you're trying to get 100 and even 110 minutes right. And that's very difficult. When I did Fish Called Wanda, which I do think was a very good film, I did 13 different drafts. I was tinkering with the characters on this draft and then trying to get the ending right on the next two and then going backwards and forwards between them. And I think that to do that takes a very, very long time.
That's writer, actor, comedian John Cleese here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He's speaking tonight in the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. Does the world need more or less silliness in dire times?
Oh, I think it needs more. I mean, Eric and I have been doing a tour. We started up in Canada and we came right the way down as far as San Diego, and then we turned left and went across Arizona and Texas and finished up in New Orleans. And I mean, it was just after the last election, and there was a kind of sense of bewilderment, and people were numbed and scared, you know, anxious about what was going to happen. And I think the very fact that people were able to sit there and laugh their heads off did them good. I don't mean it changed the world, but at least it made 2,000 people happier that evening. And that's a nice thing to be able to do. But right at the moment, I think in my life, I'm 77 now, I've never seen such congealed craziness wherever you look. You know, public taking over the house, deciding not to bother too much about ethics. I mean, you couldn't write that. If you put that in a movie, people would say, no, it's too silly. They've gone over the top. And then having to change their mind because their own president rebukes them. I mean, it's just wonderfully mad.
Let me ask this. The Daily Express in the UK quoted you last October saying of Donald Trump, quote, "I just don't get it. I look at Trump and I see a narcissist with no attention span who makes it all up as he goes along," end quote. And
yes.
I raise that because, as you know, some analysts say those who voted for Trump are similar in many ways to those in Britain who voted for Britain to leave the European Union. And you supported Brexit. So square those.
Yes, I did, but not for the reasons that most people did. You see, that's the trouble. You get shoved in a big, Hillary Clinton would say, a big basket with all the other people. And if I told you the people that I'd been reading carefully before I decided that Brexit was a good thing, these are very bright people. These are not racists or any of that nonsense. So, you know, yes, I did vote for Brexit, but it was mainly because if I thought the European Commission was capable of reform, was capable of not remaining a bureaucratic institution which basically had its own aims like a European army that no one else had ever voted for. If they weren't going to reform themselves, I thought it was better to be out, because otherwise one has no power in the situation. You're being outvoted by 27 other countries all the time, and I don't think many Americans would fancy that.
You have spoken out about political correctness and its effect on comedy in the past few years. In an interview with Bill Maher in 2014, you called political correctness condescending. How so?
Well, because if you could make jokes about Canadians or Australians or Germans or Swedes or French or the British or New Zealanders, was that because they can take care of themselves? They're proper grown-ups. You know, you don't have to protect them. But if we mention someone like Mexicans, well, we mustn't be mean to them because they can't look after themselves. I find that very condescending. I don't like mean jokes. I don't like mean jokes even if they're told about the Germans. I don't think we should be mean. But there are sort of insult jokes like, why do the French have so many civil wars, answer, so that they could win one now and again, which is funny, I think, but at the same time doesn't mean you hate the French. Look, jokes about the English. You go to Australia, they say, where do you hide a key so that an Englishman can't find it? And the answer is under the soap. People can take this sort of thing, but let's not be mean. I mean, Christ didn't say, blessed are the non-racists. Christ said, basically, don't be very mean to people. Try and treat them the way you'd like to be treated by them. That seems to be a very good principle. You don't have to bring sex or race or anything else into it.
Well, but religious groups protested Monty Python's Life of Brian when it was released.
Yes.
They thought the film was sacrilegious. Is offending people part of the fun of being a comedian?
No. They thought the film was sacrilegious because they were completely uninformed about it. I don't think anybody does anymore. Or if they do, then they are believing a kind of Christianity, which has absolutely nothing to do with what Christ talked about. The answer is people could always be offended. If you're having a lovely party with your friends and you're all laughing, having a good time, and a maid and an aunt walks in and you have to suddenly stop being a bit jolly and maybe a tiny bit vulgar and a bit boisterous and sort of sit around and be really well behaved and nice and restrained until she leaves, I mean, she hasn't actually improved the quality of life, has she? So if you have people who literally sit there waiting to be offended, it creates an atmosphere that means most people can't enjoy the show in the same way.
You have a law degree. Has that been useful to you at any point in your career?
No.
Okay, settle that. I ask because I know you co-founded this business, Video Arts, that does training films. I don't know whether it's still functioning, but you...
No, we sold it in 92.
I read that your training videos had been used by 27,000 businesses, although I noticed...
Something like that. I mean, in 20 years, we made over 200 of them, and I found them extraordinarily interesting because you had to sit down and, when I was writing them, which was the interesting part, sit down with people who were really expert, who knew how to run a meeting properly, and it was terribly, terribly interesting. Of course, the writing was hard work, but as you know, it always is.
What would you say that whole experience taught you about business?
Well, there's one principle that I think has always stood out, and that is when you have to make or take a decision, don't take it or make it until you have to. So the first question you must ask is, when does this decision have to be made? And then you wait and see if there's new information, or see if you have better ideas, better solutions, which may arrive. Sleep on that, people used to say. Allow the unconscious to come in and come up with creative ideas. And in that way, I think you can reach much better decisions. But most people want to make a decision because they can't tolerate the uncertainty of not making it. So they rush at it and make it before they need, and before maybe new information or new ideas have come in.
The first video of yours I found on your YouTube channel is titled Dead Planet. Absolutely not funny. Intentionally not funny. Tell us why you made it.
Because I think that conservation is extraordinarily important, because I think we've forgotten about it now, and I think that the wildlife on the planet is basically being destroyed. Because most people don't care. You know, the Chinese want their ivory. I mean, it's wicked, really, except that people aren't smart enough to realize how wicked they are.
You are supporting an organization called BornFree.org. What do you hope to accomplish?
Yes, that's right. Just think that anything we do to preserve wildlife and to try and, you know, keep this incredibly precious resource on the planet, we just have to do it, because most people are so obsessed with making money, they just don't care about the damage they're doing.
I've read that you yourself have a passion for lemurs.
You see, it's very easy in this business. If you do one thing, then everyone says, oh, he's got a passion for this or that. I have a general passion for trying to save animals from extinction, but I was particularly fond of lemurs because I was asked to make a program about them. And they are the most charming little things because they're very, very sweet and good-natured. And like human beings, the females are dominant.
And there's a species named after you?
Yes. Avahi clesii, Clesius woolly lemur. I've never seen one because there aren't many left. I think it's so important because I do think this is a wonderful planet, and I think that the economists who tell us how we should be behaving, and they know very little about how to live.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how annoying is it when people ask you to reenact Monty Python sketches?
Well, it depends on the context. I mean, if I was on stage, I would think it was perfectly fair. If they asked me whether I was on a zebra crossing, I would probably explain that there might be better moments.
If I asked you to enact part of the Dead Parrot sketch?
Well, I don't know if I could remember it. It is an ex-parrot, it is no more, it has ceased to be, it has run down the curtain and joined the choir invisible. This is an ex-parrot. I can only remember about 20% of it. I remember once we were going to do it on Saturday Night Live, Michael Palin and I, and the night before we had dinner together, and we couldn't remember it. We had a notebook there. We suddenly said, well, why don't we just go out and stop someone on the pavement and ask them? Because so many of the people do know this stuff by heart, rather better than we do.
You're right, people do. I would not have the nerve to ask you this, except that you did a performance tour of Canada labeled something like Last Chance to See Me Before I Die. And so
that's right.
So since you have created that frame, what's on your bucket list? What do you still want to accomplish, having accomplished so much?
I'd like to understand things a little better, because the older I get, I realize I just understand absolutely nothing. So really, I would like to have more quiet time, more time to think and to write. But that was rather disturbed by the divorce settlement, because you have to spend then a lot of time doing things that pay well, which are often not the things that are interesting.
The divorce settlement, this is your divorce from your third wife?
Third wife, I think it was.
And
yes, that's right, $20 million.
Which triggered several tours that you called the alimony tours, because you were quite frank.
That's
that
right, yes. Well, I thought it was just as well that people knew why I was doing it. There was no point in keeping it a secret. I would rather have been spending that time. I quite like entertaining audiences, but I would much rather have spent the time trying to write a film script or even a stage play.
Is that now at an end? The alimony tours are over?
Well, yes, I don't have to pay yearly alimony anymore. I haven't had for 2 or 3 years, but $20 million still makes a little bit of a dent when you're trying to buy a house, you know.
Well, I'm very glad that you're traveling to come to Baltimore. We're looking forward to having you here.
I'm looking forward to coming there because it's the city of Mr. Mencken, who's a little bit of a hero of mine. Does he work for the Baltimore Sun, didn't he?
He did.
He said some of the funniest things. I mean, when Coolidge died and the boy ran through the offices of the newspaper shouting, Mr. Coolidge is dead, and Mencken said, how can they tell? I just thought he's terribly funny in a rather black way, which of course appeals to me.
Let me just say thank you so much for talking to us.
Great pleasure, and I look forward to meeting you face to face.
I'll be interviewing John Cleese at greater length tonight at the Meyerhoff, part of the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break now on the record. When we come back, we'll hear about an art exhibit that features a giant mosaic made of toast. Okay, stay with us.